This is the Water Foresight Podcast, powered by the Aqualaris Group, where we anticipate, frame, and shape the future of water through strategic foresight. Today's guest is Elisa Speranza, who is with 7th Ward Strategies. Elisa is a former board member and officer with the American Waterworks Association, Water for People, and the Massachusetts Waterworks Association. Also, she's a diehard Red Sox fan. Elisa, welcome to the Water Foresight Podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
There is a lot happening in the world of water. One of the things that I can't seem to escape every day is the amount of information, emails, reports, papers on this term ESG, environmental, social, and governance. Elisa, what is this ESG term? What does it mean?
So ESG is kind of an umbrella term now that, and you're right, we're getting overwhelmed with all kinds of people wanting to sell us things about ESG, environmental, social, and governance. And it's just a framework for companies and other organizations to kind of organize and align their mission, their vision, their values, and their operations with stakeholders that they respond to, whether it be customers or, you know, governing boards or investors or financial institutions and various other stakeholders. So, you know, I think of it as the evolution of a few years back. We were all writing and, you know, still are, sustainability reports, and corporate social responsibility was kind of the more the buzzword. And I think now that has evolved to a more broad umbrella term of ESG, which encapsulates a lot of different factors.
That's interesting. I am, and many of our listeners may be familiar with the E of ESG, which is environmental, you know, compliance with the Clean Water Act, compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act, you know, ensuring that you have identified your carbon footprint, trying to reduce CO2 emissions. Maybe on the other side, we have the G, governance, and that may have its own issues. But if we look at the S, the dimension of the social aspect of ESG, and some of the things that we talk about with social change, tell us about your thoughts on what is the S of ESG? What does it mean? And what does that dimension look like?
It's actually pretty broad. From what I've learned, it encompasses everything from workers' rights, health and safety, which we've, you know, long paid attention to in the water sector, employee rights, human capital management, human rights, you know, so for example, you know, in a supply chain, looking at how people are treated in a company, making sure that worker welfare is accounted for. So it can be as global as that or as local as, you know, the health and safety and training of your own workforce. And then in addition to that, it also encompasses what we're doing in the community. You know, are we a good corporate citizen? Are we a good neighbor in the neighborhood where our operations are? Those kinds of things. So, you know, I think a lot of companies and even water utilities and adjacent organizations would pride themselves on being good neighbors, would pride themselves on being, or even corporate philanthropists. And I think what ESG proponents are saying now, and the S in particular, is that's not enough anymore. You know, just posing with the big check that you're giving, you know, giving money to the local food bank or whatever it is not, is great. You know, they should keep doing that, but it's not enough. And it's more about marketing sometimes than it is about actual social change or progress.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking about the supply chain implications of S. It's not only on the E side, the environmental side,
right?
But talk. If I'm a water utility, how might I look at the S in ESG in my organization?
I'll give you a great example, and it's an old example. CH2M Hill, you know, where I worked for 15 years and, you know, we always prided ourselves on being a little bit out front on sustainability and corporate citizenship. One of the early, we were early adopters for a lot of these measures, partly because of our clients. So San Francisco Public Utilities, way back, required its contractors to have a domestic partner benefit. So CH Tom Hill and other companies that were doing business with the San Francisco utility were required to change their company policies and provide health insurance, for example, for domestic partners and not just for spouses. This was way before, before the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage. So it was super important to our LGBTQ employees and to people like me who weren't married but had a domestic partner. So it's an example of the power of the buying power of a utility, how that can affect change that's in alignment with that utility's or that community's values. I'll give you a private sector example at CH Tom Hill. Health and safety was, we were safety zealots, some would call us, and proud of it.
It's a good thing.
Yep. And I still am to this day. We looked at our supply chain and made sure that our suppliers, our subcontractors, folks that were selling stuff to us, for everything from, office supplies to a subcontractor, a trade subcontractor on a big project, also had a good track record on health and safety. And some of them did not. And so, there were consequences for that, or we helped them, or they wanted to get better and we helped them do that. So just making that seemingly small change can have a ripple effect throughout the whole supply chain.
Yeah, I'm sure you have seen the same stories that I have seen over the past few years where large corporations have had first, second, third tier suppliers that have engaged in questionable behavior in different countries. And that would be perhaps another example if I am going to buy fire hydrants or I'm going to buy pipes and other materials from companies, I want to make sure that if I'm committed ESG, perhaps contractually, I ask them downstream to be committed to ESG. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And I think, there are some utilities that have been doing that for years on various topics and various issues. Seattle comes to mind, others who've had an impact because of that. And, in a market where you have choices about where you're going to procure things, having those, it's a little tricky with public procurement and building if you're taking low bids and that sort of things, but you can have threshold criteria in your procurement regs to encourage that kind of behavior, which is what a lot of utilities are starting to look at now.
That's very interesting. I can only imagine we're going to see that continue to expand across multiple sectors, not just the water sector.
Yep.
With respect to the social issues, who are, in your view, some of the key stakeholders that are driving social change in the water sector?
Probably the biggest, the biggest stakeholder is always customers. And customers are more savvy than they ever were. They have more information, whether it's accurate or not, at their disposal. Yeah. You can't hide anymore like the old days and be the silent service that a lot of water utilities wanted to be. And those days have been over for a while, whether some people like it or not. But I think that customers are driving more accountability for things. And so you're starting to see customer activists, not just on local issues, but on these more global issues. And if utilities have the wherewithal and the staffing and the interest and maybe governing boards that are driving them that way, or if they report to a city government, sometimes the city council or the mayor or the city manager, the city governance structure will be pushing it as well. So lots of different stakeholders that have an interest in what the utility does. I think that in the supply chain, there are companies that are pushing back the other way as well, which is sometimes a delicate balance. I have had clients who will remain nameless who had terrible health and safety records. And we had to kind of very, diplomatically say, you know what? We're not putting our people in your facility until everybody's got a hard hat on, things like that. So pushing our own clients to be a little more mindful of, ESG, but you know, some of these, especially worker protections.
That's interesting. With ESG, it seems that a lot of the commentary and the observations and thought leadership is coming from the financial services sector.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that that is a significant sector? And if we're going to, from the viewpoint of strategic foresight, look out, you know, 10 to 20 years, do you believe that the financial services sector will play a role in defining and shaping ESG commitments in the water sector?
100%. And they already are. In fact, just last week, one of the boards I'm on, you know, was in a conversation with one of their investors over on this, exactly this topic. At CH, we had the same conversation with some of our investors. You know, they are definitely pushing in that direction. There's a lot of activity with, you know, that among the financial sector towards more standardized formats and reporting guidance and that sort of thing, because right now there's a whole bunch of different competing guidance out there, and I think it's confusing for companies. And so I think we're starting to see, you know, those different templates kind of get coalesced together. And so we'll hopefully have some more standardized measures. But a lot of companies are already collecting the data. They're already doing some of these things, obviously, you know, they're required to by OSHA or whoever to collect data. They're just not calling it ESG, or they're not reporting it in that framework. But I think you're going to see public companies in particular, but also private companies and you know, nonprofits and water utilities as well, who are going to be pressured by the financial sector, whether it's the insurance companies pressuring them on environmental issues, for example, on climate change, or whether it's, you know, the bond market. I mean, there's going to be lots of ways that the financial sector can weigh in here, whether it's encouraging or requiring. And I think 20 years from now, we'll see a lot more requirements. Maybe 5 years from now, we'll see a lot more requirements than we have now.
It's interesting to think of what you just said in the context of many municipal utilities that borrow, they go out to go to the bond market, and they have bond covenants. And to think about the various ESG commitments that may be wedded to those covenants in the future.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. It may be out there, but I wouldn't be at all surprised to see that to come up, because I think you're already seeing a lot of attention being paid to impact investment, for example. You know, there are some very viable companies out there now looking for, and you know, outcome-based investment in water projects. And I think that's really exciting, frankly, because I think it's a whole new, first of all, it's a whole new way of accessing resources for water projects, for sustainable water projects, but it's also a way to get multiple benefits out of the same dollar invested.
In your view, if you look out in the water sector 10 to 20 years, and you look at the social dimension to this ESG paradigm, what do you think? What are some of the possible scenarios or outcomes in the next 10 to 20 years for the water sector as we look at the evolving nature of ESG?
One thing I hope to see, and I think we will, you know, I'm a very optimistic person. You know, I believe in the power of positivity. I hope that we will see a lot sooner than even 20 years, but I think we will see more diverse leadership in the water utility sector. You know, we're already seeing some movement towards diversifying our water leadership. There are folks out there running water utilities who 10 years ago, you know, would never have been running water utilities. There are people with different backgrounds, different, you know, people of color, people of different, even myself, I'm not an engineer. You know, there are a lot of non-engineers that are running water utilities now. They have other skills to bring to the table.
You might even let lawyers run water utilities.
Some of my favorite water utility managers have been lawyers, as a matter of fact. One of my old bosses was a lawyer. So I think, and I think that's all positive. I we're in a time that's been so tumultuous and so difficult, but out of the, you know, this tumultuous time, I think we're going to see some positive outcomes as well. I think the move towards more diversity, more acceptance in the workplace of different people from different backgrounds, and not just for show, you know, but for real, and moving into leadership positions and reflecting the communities that they serve. Mm-hmm. It's so important, both on in terms of utility management, but also governance. You know, yeah. The governing boards of utilities, yeah. I think, have shifted as well. And I think that's a extremely positive and needs to be supported, because we're missing out otherwise on talent, you know, and companies are doing the same thing. You know, why would you want to miss out on all that talent? Because you've got structural racism in your organization and you haven't rooted it out. So I think it needs to be talked about more and addressed, and it is being addressed head on much more now than it was even a year ago, I'd say.
One of the issues that I'm seeing is the issue of environmental justice. And we don't necessarily have to get into this issue in depth, but do you see environmental justice as being a component of the S in ESG, the social component?
Yeah, it's one of those things that kind of crosses over. And there's a lot of issues where, you know, is it an E or is it an S? And you have, you know, when you're doing your reporting, you have to kind of pick a lane. And but I think environmental justice is one of those. And it also goes to governance, too, I suppose. I think that companies and even water utilities, you know, back when I was working at the Mass Water Resources Authority and siting facilities, we, you know, I don't think environmental justice was a component of our siting criteria. That would never happen now. You know, you would always have that as part of, you know, what your siting criteria is for certain facilities. And having visited probably a couple hundred wastewater plants around the country, you see where wastewater plants get sited, for example, what part of town they end up in. Mm. I think now there's a lot more awareness, both on siting and on operations and on safety, you know, transport of chemicals even to support water and wastewater facilities. All of that is coming into play along with affordability and equity. So there's been some great work done both globally and site specifically by the U.S. Water Alliance on the whole topic of environmental justice and equity in the water sector. And I encourage people to check that out. So I think there's a lot of great work being done out there, a lot of grassroots groups that are way more educated now on water issues, on the technicalities of, you know, the technical aspect of water issues than they ever were before. Here in New Orleans, there's a groundswell of work being done on green infrastructure right down to the neighborhood level, and a lot of grassroots activists that are pushing the water utility, pushing the city's public works department. And standards have changed. So now when things get built, they're built with equity and environmental justice in mind, at least people are trying more to do that. So I think it's all positive. And, you know, when we talk about whether companies should be allowed to pollute watersheds or to ruin watersheds or to pollute water sources, I'm hopeful that we are rapidly coming back to a time where companies won't be allowed to do that anymore.
That's interesting. You touched on very briefly a number of different dimensions on the social side of ESG, and a few hypotheticals. Do you believe it might be possible in 20 years that a facility that is needs to be rehabilitated or even built to treat water or to produce drinking water could be denied based on environmental justice considerations?
Absolutely. I think that's already happening.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the pipeline fights, you know, through native lands. You know, there's lots of examples of that already. I think that's right. And I think it will force us as a society and as a water sector to take a step back and think about what we're doing, you know, and not just say, well, get out of the way. We're building this here in your neighborhood, whether you like it or not. You know, maybe we should question whether we need to build it in the first place, you know, or maybe there's a different way to address the same concern. And if we involve more stakeholders in that conversation, as messy as it can be, I think we come out with better outcomes.
You mentioned another dimension, not just the siting or permitting, but operationally.
Yes.
Those of our colleagues that are in the artificial intelligence and machine learning world have highlighted the potential for that technology to be used in a way that may present some unintended outcomes that may be discriminatory. Can you imagine 20 years from now that, let's say, a main rehabilitation program that takes place, say, over 3 years, where the renewal and replacement of the infrastructure is done through a lens of environmental justice, where the infrastructure is replaced in a more perhaps equitable fashion than it could have been in years gone by?
Wouldn't that be refreshing? yeah, I mean, I think a lot of water utilities that I'm a huge proponent of asset management. So, I think that could be incorporated into an asset management program, for example. And I haven't seen that done yet, but that would be really interesting. But, you know, if you're a community that doesn't have an asset management program and you're replacing things as they break, maybe you have, you're not so good on preventive maintenance, and you're just doing what you can to keep things running. You might respond to the squeakiest wheel, and the squeakiest wheel in many communities are the wealthier parts of town, with more representation. Yeah.
And from your experience,
I like that idea.
Asset management right now is not necessarily a legal obligation. Perhaps it is a program that many utilities adopt and implement, and it involves the replacement of infrastructure, whether it be pipes, hydrants, meters, valves, and they do it based on a multitude of criteria that may not today address the concerns of the environmental justice movement. And I think, if I hear you correctly, that could be another lens through which we execute asset management or even capital projects in the next 10 to 20 years.
Absolutely. And I think it is already in a lot of communities, certainly incorporated into their capital project decision-making, whether they're using asset management or not. I don't know enough about artificial intelligence to know how that would be incorporated, but I think it'd be super exciting, and maybe for a future episode of the podcast to look into that. But I'd love to hear from communities that are incorporating it into their asset management program. But yeah, I mean, it used to be like if the water main, you had your consequence and risk matrix, and if the water main is running down through the business district, perhaps, the consequences are rated higher. Who's to say what's important in those consequences, and did they run that to ground with the community and with other stakeholders, or did they just talk to the business community or just talk to, the developers or whatever. Yeah. So, I think it goes back to that. I teach a class at the University of Colorado, and one of our case studies is called The Case of the Forgotten Stakeholder. And we talk a lot about when you think you've talked to everyone, or you think you've reached out or listened to everyone, chances are you haven't. And what can you do to make sure that you reach more people and listen to more people, whether you thought of them in the first place or not?
One of the final questions I have, Elisa, is when you think about the social aspects of ESG and you look out 10 to 20 years into the future about what that may mean for the water sector, are there any unintended consequences that you see from ESG? Anything that you think might be on the horizon that people may not see or anticipate?
It's a good question, and there always are unintended consequences with any action. You hope that they're beneficial, but sometimes they're not. And I think it really comes back to being humble and being mindful of what those consequences could be, and making sure, as I said, to include more voices at the table so that those unintended consequences don't turn out negative and don't turn out to be harmful to people and to the planet. You could use Flint as a case study for that, I suppose. And whenever I see homogeneous groups of people making decisions on behalf of others who have not had a voice in the process, you will almost undoubtedly see unintended consequences that are negative for that group of people. So to me, it goes back to diversity. It goes back to listening. It goes back to humility. And, you know, understanding that we can't know everything, and finding the people who can help inform us and make better decisions. And when we make a mistake, to admit it and to rectify it as quickly as possible and to mitigate whatever those consequences might be.
Wonderful. Elisa, one final question. Will the Red Sox win the World Series this year?
Oh my God. If I knew that, I'd go to Vegas and bet. My expectations for the Red Sox are appropriately low. I said I was an optimist, and I think that comes from being a Red Sox fan all my life. You know, we have a bunch of new guys. I'm excited about baseball starting up again for sure, and I take it one game at a time.
Well, perhaps being a Phillies fan, I would hope that perhaps the Phillies and the Red Sox might see each other in the World Series. That would be
fun.
Preferred future in my book.
Sounds great.
Well, Lisa, I want to thank you today for being a guest of the Water Foresight podcast. And if you'd like to reach out to Elisa, you can find her on LinkedIn. And also, Lisa's on Twitter at Elisa Speranza. Thank you for listening to the Water Foresight podcast, powered by the Aqualaris Group. For more information, please visit us at aqualaris.com or follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter.